Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, it is Thursday, July 24th, 2008. You are listening to Paranexus Universe. This is Doug Kelly, your host, along with Grant Rubin Dunst, good friend, co-host. Hey, Grant.
Hey, everybody. Welcome.
Yeah.
Nice to have us tonight.
Yeah, and we've got Bill Nell back with us tonight. Another couple of hours of some very, very interesting talk, and I'll introduce him in just a moment. I did want to make a quick announcement that we've made some changes to the Paranexus conference. We've shortened it by a day. It was Thursday through Sunday. Now we've made it Friday through Sunday. And there's a couple of reasons why we did that. And I wanted to let everybody know, and I did send out an announcement to our members. The reason is that, you know, the economy with gas prices and all that, we were really trying to find some ways to where we could drive the registration fee down. And so that's what we decided to do. We haven't cut any of the workshops we had planned at all. In fact, we're going to add some more. But now we've got the registration fee at $99 for the entire conference for all 3 days. The hotel, of course, is going to be Hojo's, Howard Johnson in downtown Tampa. Really a nice hotel and great people to work with. The room rate is, I think, $92 special rate for Paranexus attendees there. And so go ahead and take a look at paranexus.org. If you've been considering the conference, we'd love to have you and join us there for some learning, some networking, to have a good time. Just $99 now for all 3 days. It's going to be October 24th, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So take a look at that, paranexus.org. Now, for tonight's guest, we're honored to have Bill Nell back with us. And just to refresh your memory on Bill, he was born in New York City in 56. He lived in New York, Florida, and Arizona. He began reading about the paranormal in 1965 at age 9. He personally investigated thousands of unexplained events. He presented his first seminar at the tender age of 15 years old, and he's presented over 1,500 to date. He's seen on hundreds of television programs worldwide, heard on over 1,000 top-rated radio programs worldwide, featured in hundreds of influential publications worldwide. He's written and produced over 40 documentaries. He's the author of hundreds of unexplained. He's experienced two UFO sightings in 1988 and in 1991, both in New York. He's a former MUFON New York State Assistant Director of the Island Skywatch and the New York UFO Report, and he was a consultant to the X-Files and major Hollywood films. Bill, welcome back to Paranexus Universe.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you guys having me. Pleasure.
With us, and we enjoyed the heck out of it. Hey, Grant.
Oh, absolutely. And for those of you that haven't been to Bill's website, I would do so. Cool site. He's got a lot of information there that for whether you're a beginner or whether you're an old salt that, you know, doing research on UFOs, Bill's site can't be beat. He does a wonderful job there, and you know, I'd encourage you to all go there. He's got some wonderful videos too, and just a ton of good stuff. So, Bill, it's wonderful to have you with us again.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the comments, and you know, we try to put as much on there as we can. It takes me a while to write it all up. You know, you try to squeeze like 40 some odd years of research, you know, into some articles, and it just takes forever. It seems like to write it all down, and I, you know, I. On my desk, I've got a whole box of stuff with like little notes and files and all kinds of things. And, you know, I'll eventually get them all before I die. You know? But at least, you know, I do it because I really want people to benefit from and enjoy some of the stuff and some of the worked on. So hopefully we've done our job with that, and I'm glad people find it interesting.
Well, before we get started with our interview with Bill, I'd like to just invite our listeners to join us in the chat room or give us a call tonight. We've got the lines open. The number's there on your screen, 347-945-7799. We'd love to take your calls. We'd love to get your questions in chat. And, Grant, I before I ask Bill a question, did you have something you wanted to start with, or do you want me to?
Yeah, I wanted to ask Bill a question. Bill, what did you think? What's your take on Dr. Edgar Mitchell's statement over there, and I think it was Trang Radio or something along those lines over in the UK, where he pretty much, I know it's not the first time Dr. Mitchell said this, but said on the air that we've been, we're well aware of aliens and been in contact with them.
Well, I was really fascinated. In fact, I've already got an article on my website about it because I became aware of it. I was kind of up in the middle of the night last night, and I became aware of it. And fortunately, I've had a chance to meet Dr. Edgar Mitchell, and of course, you have to put things in perspective, okay? You know, when someone from NASA talks about UFOs, they're either usually pro or con. You know, it's not too many people out there in the middle, but this isn't just someone. I mean, people understand. You know, Edgar Mitchell, he's like one of the 12 people that walked on the moon, okay? Let's begin there. You know, he's got 3 earned doctorates, including one from MIT. You know, the guy has all these honorary things as well, but, you know, he's a very brilliant man. He, you know, when he retired, he was a, you know, not just an astronaut, he was a Navy captain. You know, he's just had an exemplary, in fact, you know, one time he was actually in charge of the Navy's program. They were going to have their own, eventually put up their own space station, as it were, if you will, living environment in space, and he was in charge of developing that. He's done so much. And, you know, one of the interesting things about him, I first met him, I believe, if memory serves, on the Sally Jesse Raphael show. I did a show with him years and years ago, a television show, and I've done a couple of radio interviews where he was involved also. And I just really appreciated his openness because in 1972 he retired from NASA, and he retired from the Air Force, excuse me, the Navy. Boy, they'd probably like to punch me out for making that era, but from the Navy. And, you know, never to confuse the two. And in 1973, he began an institute for noetic studies. In other words, you know, powers of the mind, ESP, psychic powers. And he's always been into the, you know, he's always taken a very holistic approach to things. And especially, he was apparently has always been very interested in the paranormal. But, you know, now that's not to say, though, that he has ever made this one. This is a pretty impressive statement, because what he's saying, for those of you who didn't hear it, he's basically saying that he has been briefed on the subject of UFOs and aliens. Aliens that he's been briefed on happen to be the small type, the little gray guys, if you will, with the you know, large head, small body frames, et cetera, et cetera. He's telling us that NASA, for all intents and purposes, is lying to people about this and that there's a government cover-up. Well, big surprise, but, you know, we all sort of know that, but when we hear it from someone of Edgar Mitchell, it's a whole other thing.
Definitely.
So I was very impressed, you know. And you know what? He made a statement, an interesting statement on the radio show after he said it. He said, you know, it really feels good to be able to talk about these things, because I know for a fact the kind of pressure that these people are under. I mean, I did a show one time with Buzz Aldrin. And, you know, Buzz Aldrin's a really nice guy. He's probably one of the nicest people you ever meet in your life. But he's a poster boy for NASA. You know, he's never going to change his story. I'd be shocked if that man ever said anything that, you know, went against the grain. Simply because, you know, he was one of the first people to go to the moon. Him and Neil Armstrong and so on and so forth. And, you know, that's why, you know, if someone like Mitchell from Apollo 14. And, you know, that's another thing. NASA owes this man a debt of gratitude. What did they come out and say right after he made the statement? They said, well, you know, we don't track UFOs. That's one thing. Okay, we're NASA. We don't track UFOs. We really have very little to do with them. And we disagree with Dr. Mitchell, you know, on his assessment of the information he's given out. Well, how nice of them. They forget when he saved their butt, because he went up in the very next mission after Apollo 13, and we all know what happened then. And believe me, there was a whole cadre of people in the government, the military, and even civilians that wanted to see the space, the whole space program canceled and the money put to other things. They did not want any more. And because of his work on Apollo 14, we have to remember, he spent 9.5 hours on the moon. 9.5 hours. He set a record, him and Alan Shepard. And they spent a total, and that's on one moonwalk. Now, just remember that. That's one moonwalk. Imagine the physical strain on the body to do that. And they spent together, collectively, they set a record of spending 33 hours on the moon's surface. It was the longest of any Apollo mission.
Really?
So, in other words, as humans, they spent more time on the moon than any other human beings. So, you know, they did it on purpose, because what they were trying to do, they were trying to show people, look, accidents happen, but the space program is safe. You know, we should continue to go to the moon, continue doing these things. And, you know, it was a 9-day mission. And when he returned from the mission, I believe it successfully reestablished the credibility of NASA and the space program. And this is how they thank him. And this is such a classic. It's like what we talked about last time, how I hear these stories from you know, Air Force pilots, national heroes, until they start talking about UFOs. Then the government would say, oh, they were suffering from depression or probably had a bad day or something. You know, I'm just actually kind of surprised they slammed the door on Mitchell so fast. I really kind of thought they'd just say, well, we don't have any comment. But I guess, you know, because of his statue, they were just going to make sure that they really slammed it hard. And I guess...
Well, you know, I'm currently... getting close to finishing Stanton Friedman's new book, Flying Saucers and Science. And I just wanted to tell everybody that. It's a great book. I mean, I've enjoyed it. And it's really brought home just how skeptical and uninformed much, if not most, of mainstream science is toward paranormal events. And so it doesn't surprise me that NASA, you know, the scientists, are going to poo-poo it. I said poo-poo on the radio.
Well, you know, if people go to my website, along with the article, one of the things I've got is I've got a photo that was taken during the Apollo 14 mission of a UFO. So even during that mission, we have proof positive that indeed Edgar Mitchell did see something he couldn't explain and actually photograph it. But like I said, you know, that he's certainly taking it up the ante and taking it a bit further by saying that, hey, you know, the government's definitely covering up. And, you know, I think that he probably hopes for disclosure as much as the rest of us. But, you know, as much as we hope for it, I just don't see it anywhere on the, you know, I mean, it'd be easy to say, oh, see, now he's come forward, so maybe that's a prelude to it. I don't think so. I think that Edgar Mitchell is pretty much a force of nature of his own and has always spoken his mind his own way. And I don't think he'd ever be anyone's lapdog, and I'm pretty certain that he did this because of he felt like it was time to tell people what he knew, you know, as much as he could tell, I imagine. And I unfortunately, I don't think you're going to see that too often in the near future from government agents or, you know, government folks or elected officials or even other astronauts. I wish that were not true, but it is.
Yep. I'm with you. So... what's been going on? Anything new with the Stevensville, Texas sighting?
Well, you know, one of the things I was very happy to see, and I have to commend MUFON. You know, I've hit him pretty hard in the newsletters because, really, I felt that the investigation they did on the original investigation they did on Stevensville was really a travesty. Because, I mean, look, I've been doing this stuff. Let's be honest about it. Let's straighten it out with the audience right now. There's no UFO experts. There's UFO researchers and investigators. That's what there is. Because, hey, you know, until we know everything the government knows about UFOs, because they've got a lot more money and people and time to put into it, or meet the aliens ourselves and can interview them, there's no experts. It's just a bunch of people with a huge database of information. But I have to say that I thought their first investigation was just terrible, and it ignored most of the evidence. What they did was, all they did was focus on the forms that people filled out and sent to them, which really is a very... You know, it's a very narrow-minded view. So I was really happy when some other MUFON people filed Freedom of Information requests and got the radar data. That really helped. Now, the radar data supports some interesting things. The radar data supports the fact, in fact, I was very happy about it because one of the first things that I did, anybody else did, I had said that we received a call from a guy who was a former defense worker. He had worked on F-16s on the refurbishing of them, and he had told me that, one, they would never be that many F-16s in the sky at night on a training exercise, or during the day, likely, on a training exercise, that is. And he said, too, if there were, it was probably because somebody violated or was about to violate some very seriously restricted airspace for the space over the Bush Ranch. And I, of course, wrote that up at the time and put it right out there to people. And now it turns out that the radar data from the MUFON folks supports that. At least one of the objects that was seen in the January 8th sighting in Stevensville was indeed headed either to or from the Bush Ranch. So we know that, yeah, that thing must have simply violated the airspace. And even though the president wasn't there at the time, that really doesn't matter, the violation, and it was definitely going to cause a very fast and, military response.
Well, maybe the aliens are as pissed off at Bush as the rest of us, you know. Maybe they want to go tell him. That was just a joke, okay? Just a joke.
Oh, okay.
Okay, well, that one fell flat, didn't it? You still with us, Bill?
Did they scramble those F-16s, Bill? What's the story on that?
That question. I'm getting a little bit of I'm getting a lot.
Yeah.
Let me try some things here. Try it again, Grant.
Oh, okay, Bill. I was a little bit unclear because I'm having little weather problems on my end here too. Did they scramble the F that day? Do you know?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear your question at all. I apologize. I'm just getting a lot of feedback.
Are you getting an echo,
Bill?
Go
ahead, Doug, see if you can give it a whirl.
Are you getting an echo, Bill?
Like an echo, yeah. I couldn't hear. It sounds like a repetitive. I'm sorry, I apologize. I couldn't hear
it. It's the Skype gods are not smiling on us tonight yet.
Now it sounds better now.
Okay. Grant, give it one more try.
You bet. Bill, did they scramble the F-16s that day? Have you ever verified any of that?
Well, this is what I know. As I said, I heard from someone who basically said, you know, he wasn't directly involved in this incident, okay? But he had certainly worked on F-16s for like 15 years. And as a, you know, civilian contractor, he was involved with quite a bit of the training exercises and stuff to test the new equipment, the upgrades that they put in the F-16. So, he knew a lot about training missions, and one of the things he pointed out that I believe is true is that they would have never sent up that many F-16s for a training mission at one time, especially at night, for no reason, and the fact that, of course, one of the big lies was that they were in the training mission area. They were not. They were in an area on the map that was actually not reserved for training missions. It was just, it could have been any plane could have been in there. In fact, one of the other people I heard from was a civilian pilot. He contacted me and said that he actually saw these pilots, if you will, and the objects heading away from the direction of the Bush Ranch, which is from that general area. And he felt also that they were probably, there was something that happened there first, and it was kind of like, you know, completing or heading towards the Stevensville area. So we had that from two different people. But I think the contractor was trying to point out that this had to be something where just a bunch of F-16s were scrambled and they were on afterburners for a reason. You know, they were going to get whatever this thing was. It was, you know, violating airspace. Now, violated the now based on the radar, but who knows what else it did? I mean, there were other objects that were seen, near Dallas-Fort Worth and so on and so forth. And then over the next month and even before that, there were objects seen all over Texas. And now come to hear on the news today some very interesting news, because I just heard, I don't know, did you guys hear Robert Hastings the other night talking about how that he believed that the aliens were changing the missile codes and such?
Yeah, I got a little bit of that. Yeah, was that on Larry King?
Yeah, I believe it was, but now here's the thing. Now today, a civilian agency that is kind of a watchdog agency has made a statement that in fact Air Force missile codes were mishandled. Now, what does that mean? Well, you know, this is a recurring theme. There's a lot of weird stuff going on. I noticed it started, I believe, 2 years ago with the computers. There were all these computer problems, and all of a sudden the military was having all these things with the computers, and then some of the launch codes were getting messed up, and then there was the thing where they sent, apparently allowed some sort of aircraft from the Air Force to fly across the country with live nukes aboard when they shouldn't have been on board. And, you know, and most of it was due to some kind of computer or digital era. So, I mean, you know, it kind of brings home the fact that Hastings is probably absolutely right, that, you know, there is some manipulation. And that doesn't surprise me because, I mean, you can go back to, you know, some of the early books by Donald Kehoe, you know, famous Air Force officer and certainly someone who's been involved with flight since the, I believe, the 1920s, served at the Pentagon during World War II. You can read his books on UFOs. He has, you know, every page has like five or six incidents involving the military. You know, I believe his book is called Flying Saucers Are Real. If you ever get a chance, go back and read any of his books. He's got about five of them that are available online. Most of them are now free. You just download them because, you know, you'll find out immediately that this is a recurring theme of, you know, alien manipulation, if you will, constant presence over air bases, you know, the Bentwaters case, all these other cases. But not just that, the absolute, manipulation, like at Maelstrom, where they just, you know, literally played around with the missile code. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on, and I'll tell you, things have been heating up. I liked one of the comments that Edgar Mitchell made, the astronaut, because when he said all this stuff, it seems like there's so much going on right now, it seems like they want to visit us a little bit more than they have in the past, which I think is a pretty accurate assessment.
What do you think that's true, or do you think it's just getting in everybody's consciousness? It's getting more widespread, the knowledge of it. What do you think?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
Let me try messing with the volumes again. You said that there's more activity. Is that true, or attribute it to more widespread knowledge of aliens and so forth?
Actually, I think there's a lot more activity. Let me explain why. There's a lot less coverage of UFO events. For example, years and years ago, when something happened, it managed to leak out to the news. It would either leak out because someone at an Air Force base or a Navy base or whatever, a Coast Guard station, whatever, an Army Air Force, a Marine Corps, somebody would call and tell somebody about it, or they had sources. You know, in those days, the media covered these things, and I'm talking about the days of the 40s, 50s, 60s, and even part of the 70s. You know, this was news that was important, and actually, the news media was interested in bringing out to the public. They no longer have that interest. You know, to them, they've bought into the, for some reason, you know, UFOs have become the ugly duckling of news, you know, news, even though it's good for the tabloids, it's bad apparently for the evening news. They chuckle about it and go on to the weather, you know, for some reason. I guess in order to be sophisticated and brilliant, you have to put UFOs and aliens on your politically incorrect, I'm not going to believe it list kind of thing, you know. I don't know, but I do know that more is happening because if you go online, the first thing you find out, I mean, if I just went by the reports that I get, and lately they've been piling in, I'm not even be able to keep up with them, to be honest with you, and there's been some pretty amazing reports. I mean, if you get a chance to go to my newsletter page on the website, you can look on the UFO update section, and you'll see a pile of the reports that I have been able to process, and some interesting stuff, including a guy that actually worked as the local Blue Book officer at his military facility. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on out there, and I think there's more going on now than ever before.
Your website, since you mentioned it.
My website's at UFOGuy.com. That's UFOGUY.com. People could stop by and see all that stuff.
A lot of good info there. Okay, so... there hasn't been any sightings since, what, last January in Stevensville, is that correct?
Hello?
Hello. Can you hear us?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
No problem. Have there been any sightings since last January?
Where?
In Stevensville, Texas.
You know, there's a great website that I recommend people go to. It's called StephenvilleLights.com. Basically, Stella Joyner, who was the journalist who first wrote some of the she wrote about the January sightings, and ultimately, unfortunately, was asked to leave the paper. You know, after bringing up their readers, I guess they just felt that she was doing too much on the UFOs. But goodness, not cover real news. Let's cover the local cattle sales and stuff. More important. But anyway. She has a wonderful website, and I know that she's commented on the latest information. And whenever something happens, notices. I do get a lot of reports from Texas. I have had some from Erath County, but it seems like people now have gotten to the point that they're kind of afraid to come forward and say much about what's really going on. I know that Ricky Sorrells, who was one of the original witnesses, who said that, now his sighting was a little different. He said he saw this huge saucer literally blackened out the sky in a piece of property that was right behind his house. It's also later that they had some problems with government harassment and helicopters flying over the place and buzzing and jets doing likewise in the middle of the night. And a lot of this, you know, what amazes me is a lot of this has been on film, that people have got on cell phone cameras, and yet you see nothing about it. Where's 2020? Where's 48 hours? Why aren't they over there covering this stuff, you know? And so there's a lot of things going on, but I personally believe the government has slammed the lid on the place. You know, I'm not sure how they do that these days. I know how they did it in the old days, but, you know, when you've got military officers walking up your driveway and staring at you and you're afraid to come out of your house, which is what happened with Ricky. You got to know that the government's, you know, they're doing something there. It almost reminds me of the Kecksburg case in Pennsylvania where they came in and took over the town. They actually went to his house. I spoke to her years after the event. That occurred in 1965, but I've been to Kecksburg a few times. And she said, they came into my house, didn't even bother ringing the bell. And they said, well, you know, we're going to need to use your house for a couple hours. And they got on our phone and started making long-distance calls. I think they ran up about $150 or $200 phone bill, which in those days was pretty high. Just in the few days they were there. And, you know, that's what they do. You know, I don't know if they declare martial law. I know there's all these interesting laws in the National Security Act, which, of course, was signed by Harry Truman on board his presidential plane in 1947, which really created the CIA, you know, the whole system we work under today, and kind of restricted information from the elected officials, including the president, but gave the military a huge amount of authority, as well as the CIA, to deal with things like UFOs. And I'm not talking about, you know, the MJ-12 documents. I'm talking about, you know, just the National Security Act itself. So there's a lot of things they can do. And I'll tell you, if they want to, they could shut you down pretty fast.
All right. Let's address that question after the break. We're going to take a quick break and make some volume adjustments, hopefully. We're talking with Bill Nell, UFO guy, very knowledgeable person, and a nice guy to boot. That's always a good combination, you know. Be sure and visit Bill's website, ufoguy.com, and hang with us. We'll be back in just a minute. Hi, this is Doug Kelly, founder of the Spirit Team. We perform professional paranormal research and investigations at no charge to you. If you are experiencing mysterious events in your home or business, please contact us. We maintain your privacy and we won't think you're crazy. And if you're a paranormal researcher, we offer an accredited certification course that will enhance your knowledge of the paranormal field and raise credibility with your clients. For more information, please visit our website at spiritteam.org. That's spiritteam with one T, .org.
Is there a suppression of UFO and alien information by our government?
Does the soul continue on after we die?
Climb aboard the black ship of paranormal radio with your host, Captain Jack, on Contact Talk Radio and KRWM 106.9 FM HD3. Or visit WPRTradio.com for more information.
Where will you find a professional association of paranormal researchers?
Paranexus.org.
Where can you get research training, share data, and network with other researchers?
Paranexus.org.
Where will you find a set of international standards for paranormal research groups?
Paranexus.org.
Paranexus is a global professional association of progressive paranormal investigators, parapsychologists, cryptozoologists, ufologists, and psychically gifted individuals focused on understanding the human condition through the scientific study of paranormal and psychical phenomena. And coming October 2008 to Tampa, Florida, the Paranexus Conference, a learning and networking event unlike any you've attended. Join us for 2 full days of innovative paranormal workshops. Participate in the Paranexus Challenge, where several teams will investigate a secret haunted location. Observe a live table-tipping seance at the stroke of midnight. Join us for the Spirits and Shadows Costume Ball. See old friends, meet new friends, win prizes, and have fun.
Paranexus.org.
A place to learn, a place to share, a place to network, a place to come together. Join us now at Paranexus.org. And we're back. This is Doug Kelly, your host, Paranexus Universe, along with Grant. Hey, Grant.
Hey, everybody. Welcome.
And we're talking with our special guest, Bill Nell. Welcome back, Bill.
Well, thank you.
And we made a few adjustments. We're getting feedback on sound quality kind of across the board. I think it's just going to fluctuate in and out for whatever reason. So hopefully we can hang in there and make the best here.
And we got some weather conditions at both ends, too, so everybody be patient with us. You usually are. We really appreciate it.
And Bill's got some weather going on up there, too. And well, where are you, Bill?
We're in Indiana.
Okay, in Indiana. All right, so just before the break, you were talking about the government can shut you down if you've seen something or want to talk about something. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Well, you know, over the years, I've met a lot of people who have, you know, claimed to work for the government, and you know, some of them are very legitimate. One of the people I've met was Bill English, who talked about secret Blue Book Report 13, and I talked to him for a very long time when I was investigating that, a really long time, like months. And I really enjoyed the conversations we had. And, you know, being an Air Force brat, I could tell from what he was telling me that, you know, he did have an extensive experience in the military, and I had no reason to doubt, you know, what he was saying. But I noticed, you know, they basically, you know, after he was shown the secret Blue Book report and so on and asked a few questions about it, they basically threw him out of England, you know. I mean, it just sent him back to the United States and kind of left him high and dry. And really, you know, I think that's the story of most of the people that have been involved with the government and talked about it. I mean, we were talking off the air about Bill Cooper, who, you know, died in 2001, but before he did, for many years, probably at least 20 that I'm aware of, he had spoken to and spoken about some of the things that he experienced as a naval officer, and after that, some of the things that he discovered while investigating the UFO cover-up. And, of course, you know, I think there's some kind of a threshold. I don't know what it is, but I'm almost like a magical threshold. You know, when you cross over it, if you go a little too far, that they will shut you down. I mean, you know, I don't know if I can't say for sure that I know for a fact that the government's actually done away with anybody, but you know, you hear a lot of these stories. I mean, you know, people that just suddenly die mysteriously, or they have a heart attack, or, you know, they're just suddenly gone. You hear the story of Morris Jessup, who in the 1950s was investigating the Philadelphia experiment, a guy who never suffered from depression, never had a problem in his life in that sense. And then all of a sudden, when he's going to go and meet with his congressman in Washington and talk about what he found out about flying saucers and the Philadelphia experiment stuff, all of a sudden, you know, he dies in Florida along a highway. You know, he's found with all his paperwork that he was supposed to be bringing to Washington gone. And, you know, the a hose running from the exhaust pipe into his car, making it look like he committed suicide. So who knows? But I definitely believe there is a threshold, and I always worry about people crossing it. You know, I just don't know how far. I know that whatever, you know, we talked earlier about Edgar Mitchell and the astronaut that recently came forward, you know, the last few days and talked about the fact that he has been briefed on UFOs and aliens, that they're real, they're visiting the planet, NASA knows about it, NASA denies that, but, you know, I don't think they could do much about him, except, you know, he's 77 years old, so they'll probably figure, well, you know, he's old, and maybe he's just, you know, talking through his hat, and people probably won't believe him anyway. I think their biggest fear is for someone really, you know, on the cutting edge, someone currently in government, perhaps a sitting senator or an influential House member, a president, a vice president, a secretary of defense, something like that. You know, I think their biggest fear is that one of them will get information, come forward and talk about it. I know that the Clintons, when they were in, they went through a lot of trouble to try to get information about UFOs and pretty much were stonewalled at every attempt they did. But, you know, it's not just them. I mean, you know, I know President Reagan did the same thing. And, you know, I had heard, I think it was in the mid-'80s, someone had told me that was an aide to a congressman. He had said that Reagan had once asked his vice president, Bush, and of course Bush, you know, former head of the CIA and, you know, big-time government player, a man who refused Jimmy Carter information about UFOs when he became president. I think he pretty much told Reagan, you know what, I'd like to tell you, but, you know, I'm not going to, pretty much. So, you know, I think that you'd have to be someone pretty important and have a pretty valid reason to be told what the government knows about UFOs. If not, and you do happen to luck out or find out something, they will shut you down.
Hmm. Here's a question from the chat room. Have you ever had helicopters buzz your house?
You know what? I've never had it at my house, but one thing that did really spook me was a couple of times that's happened to me when I've been at the homes of people who've had experiences. For example, I was at an abductee's house. You guys remember the last time I was on, I told a story about the gentleman whose car was lifted off the road by a UFO in Long Island. And he had had a number of UFO abductions over the years, a lot of very interesting experiences. That's the one where also on his block when he was a kid, a big, huge disc came literally right down the block. It was seen by everyone in the neighborhood. And a couple of times when I was over his house after we found a crop circle in the backyard, I mean, we had the standard completely black helicopters just, you know, buzzing his house. I mean, the darn things, you know, you almost couldn't hear. And interestingly enough, after they left, we decided to follow them as much as we could, and they actually landed out of MacArthur Airport. They have a special area in those days. This is probably about 1988, 89. They had a special area of the airport on Long Island where that the government used. I believe it was the National Guard. And I actually was able to go over and get some photos from a distance of the helicopters. And, in fact, they were black helicopters. There were absolutely no, that I could see, insignia on them or identification numbers, nothing. And there was five of them out there. There was only one buzzing that house, but they were sitting out there. I saw them, and I photographed them, and I show that in my seminar. In fact, interestingly enough, later on, the following weekend, they actually put one of them on display by accident at an air show that they held at MacArthur, and as soon as they realized it wasn't a standard military helicopter but a black helicopter, you wanted to see people come and tow that thing off the field fast. Now, it was funny, because I went up to one of the guards guarding it. I said, I'm not trying to be funny, but just one of those black helicopters, because I don't see any insignia. I mean, if I were to look at the thing, I wouldn't know if it was Army, Navy, Air Force, or CIA. And the guy got all upset, went and told somebody. Next thing I know, 10 minutes later, it was out of there. So I got some photos of that, too. I've had some pretty interesting experiences. But, I've been buzzed, but just not my house. You know, so I guess, but like I said, that really had some major experiences with UFOs. It's kind of like, I guess, the government's way of saying, you know, don't talk to him, you know, especially not him, because he's going to go tell everybody about it, you know.
Well, is there any new details whatsoever with Stevensville? I mean, I guess you'd already just mentioned that these UFO or this UFO was.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
You'd already mentioned that the Stevensville UFO was violating Bush's airspace, right?
Yes.
Okay. So do you think that's why the UFO was there. They were doing something funky in that area over Bush's area, Bush's ranch.
Oh, I'm almost certain of it. I mean, you know, see, what's happening is, and I think it probably started right when the Phoenix Lights thing began, or maybe about a year before that, because, I mean, I was traveling. I was doing seminars at the time, and I was actually in, I've lived in Phoenix for 9 years, but I was in Phoenix at the time when the when the Phoenix Lights appeared. And, you know, for that event and probably events that happened a year before that was kind of like the starting point for outrageous UFO activity. I mean, you had all the UFOs appearing over Mexico City, appearing in Mexico, working their ways up through the Southwest. Now we're seeing them here in the Midwest, you know. And I know you guys have had a lot of sightings down in Florida. And not only sightings, but sightings in conjunction with power outages, which isn't anything new. I mean, I lived in Florida a good piece of my life, and I know that there was a lot of that when I was there. So, but I think what's happened is you've seen an upswing of that, and for some reason they're becoming very bold. They're just appearing, and I think that the military and the government's finding it harder and harder to keep coming up with excuses to cover it up. I mean, the only luck they're having is the fact that the press is just too preoccupied with politics as usual and other things to be bothered. But you know what? If they ever got somebody who was really sharp, an anchor or something that really took some interest in UFOs, they'd be in trouble. Because, you know, I'll tell you, as an investigator, you know, also in a sense a reporter, because I write articles about these things, I know there's a lot of questions that they can't or won't answer. And especially if someone were to take the time to ask those questions, you know, about some of these sightings and some of these appearances of UFOs over military bases and restricted airspaces, and even over Washington. There's been at least 3 sightings over Washington, D.C. in the last year and a half, and I don't think I've heard thing one on the news about that. In fact, I don't even think I've seen much about it online, except on some of the more dedicated UFO sites. So, you know, like the O'Hare incident over Chicago Airport, and I used to speak in Chicago all the time, so I can tell you that there's a lot of sightings over that city, a lot of sightings over New York City, and all on the upswing over the last 20 to 30 years.
Amazing. Amazing. Okay, so there is one other question in the chat room that came in a little bit ago. Let's see. This is kind of relating to the 2 weeks ago when you were on. She wants to know, have you come to any conclusions as to the why of abductions?
About abductions?
Yeah, as to the why question. Why are they happening? What do you
think? Man, that's so tough. That is really one of the toughest questions I get, because, you know, I want to say they're happening because there's a need for the alien race that's doing them to do them. You know, I mean, that's the most obvious answer. In human standpoints, you could say, again, I think I said this last time, I wish I could be more definitive, but, you know, and I've been studying abductions for a long time. I mean, when I started this in Florida, you know, as a kid, some of the first cases I came across were in fact abductions. In fact, the very first case I started with was 9 kids with missing time. So, I mean, you know, I have had a lot of experience with abductions. The problem is, until we can get with these creatures and say to them, why are you doing this? I suspect the government knows why, but I don't think they're going to tell us. So my best guess is, you know, it could be a scientific study, could be a long-term study. You could go with the Zichin theory that you know, we're actually the result of genetic manipulation, and they're checking up on us still over the years. It's just there could be a million reasons. There could be the reason of, you know, creating hybrid babies. I mean, I've worked on cases where women who claim that they couldn't possibly have gotten pregnant got pregnant, then the pregnancy was taken from them after a month or two or three. And, you know, the belief that we're somehow there's a need to stabilize the DNA or improve it of another society, you know, some alien society. There's just so many different answers. And unfortunately, there's no pat one answer except to say that, you know, I believe UFO abductions are happening. I believe there's a need for them because these creatures seem to tag people. And they seem to, you know, moving away will not help. You can move where you want. They're going to follow you. And that's a proven fact. I've known kids that were experiencing this that I grew up with, that basically, even when they went on vacation, they were taken. And there was some level of evidence to prove it. People would see UFOs in the area at the same time it happened. So we know it's going on, but the real question, you know, the question we want answered as humans, as far as why, I don't know that we're going to get that answer anytime soon. I wish I could do better.
Yeah, I know. We all We all want those answers. You know, we all are trying to figure out this thing. You know, Bill, let me ask you this question. In my experience, it's almost like we are being played, and I'm talking about researchers. It's like you get one piece of information that seems credible from one source, then you get another piece of information that casts doubt on the first piece of information, and it just goes around and round and round in circles. Have you ever had that?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, I look at UFOs and paranormal research in general. I go through these times of what I call like pinnacle events, you know, just when I think I've kind of the top of what I'm going to get, like, man, this is just the best darn case that I've ever had in my life. You know, there's another case topper that comes along to top it, and I've learned, you know, never to say that's got to be it, because it never is. There's always something else that's even more cool that comes along later. But I got to say, the one kind of like defense that you have against that is, while I do certainly focus on national issues as well as my own investigations, you know, and I report on them because I think people are interested in what's going on globally in terms of UFOs, I try to sort out the wheat from the chaff. You know, I try to go and find out what's good and what's not, and I research the stories and look them up and, you know, try to talk to people, get comments when I can, you know, because really the best way to avoid that is just to do your own research. I really like talking about my own cases more than anything else, only because I can vouch for them better. You know, I've been personally met the folks and, you know, been to their houses and been to the places where the things have happened or had a chance to really dig in, you know, like you guys do. You guys do a really wonderful job. You know, you go out there and you do yeoman's duty. You know, you go out and you go to the people's homes. And like, the work you did on Stan Romanek's case, you know, amazing work. And I hope that really everyone listening will support your website and support you and go to your conference, because that's how these things, that's how information's shared, and that's how this the paranormal research community moves forward. But like I said, as far as I'm concerned, I prefer to stick with my own stuff just because, you know, there is going to be some disinformation. I mean, I talked about on the last show how that you could liken that idea to, if you can imagine one guy sitting around 24 hours a day, or at least as long as he could stay awake, and typing out disinformation on a computer. Now imagine 10,000 people like that, and you pretty much have an idea of what the government can do. I mean, I've seen them just, oh, man, like the Stevensville thing. They played that beautifully. I mean, they had the media eating out of their hands. They turned a case that really should have been in the news for not just a day, but days and even weeks. They shut it down just by saying, well, you know, we weren't out there. We didn't track nothing. Then we made a mistake. Okay, we were out there, but that's what people saw. It was wonderful. I believe they made that misstep on purpose. I think that was a purposeful thing. I don't think the guy that made the statement did it on purpose, but I think he was manipulated. You know, if you go back and you read the history of Roswell and the really amazing cover-up job that General Ramey did, because he was an absolute master when it came to manipulation of the press, if you read about how he handled things, he absolutely had everybody, you know, just running and doing everything he wanted them to do, and even making missteps on purpose so that in the end there was always more questions than answers. And there's people like that with a real gift for it in the government, and that's all they do all day long. So we do have to be careful about that. But, you know, like I said, the key is stick with your own work, and when you can't, just make sure you verify things and, you know, try to learn their game. I mean, that's why you watch the government. I've always said, if you want to find the bone, you got to watch the dog that buried it and follow them. And when you learn how the government works and how they handle these things and can figure it out for yourself, then you're wise, you know, and not like the media just believing every press release you read.
Cool. Grant, do you have any questions for Bill?
I'm back from the ether. It's so nice to be back and talking to you guys. Well, I was a little bit out there. What were you guys talking about? Well, you know, one of the things that I think I got a tail end of it, but one of the things that ongoing onslaught of disinformation that we seem to get all the time, and it's hard to really know what's true and what isn't.
Well, that's right. I mean, again, you have to use your own best judgment. See, one thing great. You know, I'll tell you something, and I really hope that people take this to heart that want to do, you know, this type of thing, want to investigate UFOs and start little UFO clubs and organizations. You know, the key is that your best tools is not going to be, you know, a piece of paper and a pad or a video cam or a digital photographic camera or EMF meters or digital recorders. None of that. Your best tool is going to be the brain in your head. And the more information you can accumulate, good information that you know about, the good cases, you're going to discover that there's a certain commonality out there, whether you're studying ghosts or ESP or, you know, UFOs or any type of phenomenon. There's definitely things. You know, one thing I love about UFOs is that they do the same thing in your area and my area that they do all over the rest of the world. There's very little difference. There's some, but not much. And they've been doing it for a really, really long time. You know, if nothing else, they're stagnant in that sense. So we can go back to our little, you know, commonality incidences that are in our brain, and we can figure out what's good and what's not. You know, if somebody all of a sudden comes up with something totally new, and it doesn't seem to wash, you know, clean, and nobody can really verify it, then, you know, you kind of have to, you can keep it in your files, but you're not going to necessarily buy into it. Because like I said, commonality is a very powerful weapon when it comes to figuring out what's good from what's bad.
What do you think, Bill? Do you think we'll figure it out?
You think we'll ever figure it out? Well, you know what? I think we have it figured out pretty good, considering the fact that we're dealing with a government that doesn't want to tell us anything. See, you know what? I'll never forget this. And by the way, I'm pretty politically neutral because I'm one of these people who believes that no matter who you vote for, you know, it pretty much doesn't matter. You know, the die has been cast.
Right.
And I got to tell you that I remember George Bush Sr. One time these people asked him about all these POWs, something on the order of, I don't know, there might have been 9,500 or 9,000 that were never accounted for after the Korean War that they believe that the Russians took and either killed or captured and never returned. And he told everybody, look, sit down and shut up. And literally what he said. Now, see, there's something, and Clinton was no better. Anytime he asked Bill Clinton a question that he didn't like the answer, he'd say, well, you know, I'm not going to talk about that. You know, it's almost as if they've reached Mount Olympus, and we're all down here on the ground. And even though we put them there, or at least we hope we put them there, they just don't feel obligated to tell us much of anything. If they don't like the question, they're just not going to answer it. They don't feel like these are important matters, you know. If it doesn't cover their agenda, there is no agenda. So, you know what, I think we've done pretty good as UFO researchers and paranormal researchers, considering the fact that we've had very little, if no help, if any help at all, from the government, and that in fact, at best, they've lied to us, at worst, they've deceived us, and, you know, we've managed to figure out that there's different type of aliens, we've managed to figure out what they do, to an extent, how they do it. Thanks to people like Bob Lazar and others, we have a little bit of a potential clue about the propulsion they use, and scientists out there that have lied to us as well. Donald Menzel, you know, I think that his pronouncements and others, and you know, that's really something to think that you can't even trust if they've worked for the government to one extent or another. So you know, I think that we've all done pretty. I guess at some point you just have to be satisfied. I mean, you know what? I look at the database of stuff that I've gotten. There's so darn much of it. I'm a thankful guy for the experiences I've had come across. You know, if I died tomorrow, I would die a happy man in terms of what I've come up with because I know so much when I first started.
That's good.
Hey, Bill, do you buy into that, to the theme that Kennedy was the last president who really was kind of briefed by the plane, and that everything's become so compartmentalized over the ensuing years that one of the reasons why the politicians talk about it is that they simply don't know about it very much, or they've only been briefed on a very, very low level as to what might be going on. And to me, it's feasible if you've got a lot of black ops and projects going on in the background that they want to have the president to have some sort of plausible deniability.
I agree with you, but you know what? I think at some point, if you are president or you are an elected official, you know, you owe your constituents something. And if everyone says, look, there's something going on here that we need to know about, you know, maybe you can't get all the answers, but you know what? Try to get some of them. Don't just shut people down, you know? And don't allow the agencies under you. I mean, how dare they allow NASA to lie to people? You know, the government accounting office and the General Services Administration have said that NASA is the most deceptive agency in the United States government. I mean, if we always think that that's the CIA or somebody, but if they're saying NASA is, that's horrible. That's a terrible thing. And if I were president,
to hear NASA talk, if NASA toots their own horn about how open they are, one of the things that I've noticed, and I don't know if you picked up on it, Bill, I still haven't seen the gas or the results of the tests that were done on Mars by the Polar Lander. They were done 2 or 3 weeks ago, and we haven't heard anything about that test.
I've heard nothing, but you know,
nothing.
Well, they did start to say. Now I got to remember, they said there were problems with the test. Remember that? They did say that. You know, isn't it amazing how there's always problems, you know, and probes just manage to vanish out of nowhere every time they find some potential for life? I mean, it always seems like that. It amazingly happens, you know.
I thought that was especially interesting in light of the couple days before that had said that, you know, that the soil composition on Mars was remarkably similar to what was going on here on Earth, and that it wasn't hostile towards life forms. So I thought that was really interesting because they were supposed to do that test that was going to heat up all of the soil to like 1,000 degrees, and then we were supposed to get the results, and they kept us hanging for a week, and I haven't noticed anything. And I go there every day.
Well, you know, years ago I did a press conference with Dr. Brian O'Leary, who was a space shuttle astronaut and space scientist. And I remember asking him something about Mars, and he kind of joked, he kind of laughed, and he said, well, you know what, if you're waiting for NASA to tell you something, it'd be faster for you to try to get to Mars yourself and see what it looks like than to wait for them to tell you the truth about what's really going on there. And that's coming from a space shuttle astronaut and a space scientist. So I think that's a pretty good answer.
Right. Yeah, and in all fairness to NASA, it may be that it's taken a long time, too. You know, I'm just impatient.
All right, we're coming up at the top of the hour, and we're going to take a short break. We appreciate everyone listening in, and there is a question in the chat room pertaining to more of a haunting kind of an issue, a blend of hauntings and UFOs. We'll address that after the break, and Bill will talk more about some of your paranormal non-UFO type of work. Sound good?
Sounds good to me.
All right, so folks, hang with us. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Paranexus Universe with Doug Kelly, Grant Rubendunst, and our guest, Bill Nell. Hi, this is Doug Kelly, founder of the Spirit Team. We perform professional paranormal research and investigations at no charge to you. If you are experiencing mysterious events in your home or business, please contact us. We maintain your privacy, and we won't think you're crazy. And if you're a paranormal researcher, we offer an accredited certification course that will enhance your knowledge of the paranormal field and raise credibility with your clients. For more information, please visit our website at spiritteam.org. That's spiritteam with one T, .org.
Is there a suppression of UFO and alien information by our government? Does the soul continue on after we die? Climb aboard the black ship of paranormal radio with your host, Captain Jack, on Contact Talk Radio and KRWM 106.9 FM HD3. Or visit WPRTradio.com for more information.
Where will you find a professional association of paranormal researchers?
Paranexus.org.
Where can you get research training, share data, and network with other researchers?
Paranexus.org.
Where will you find a set of international standards for paranormal research groups?
Paranexus.org.
Paranexus is a global professional association of progressive paranormal investigators, parapsychologists, cryptozoologists, ufologists, and psychically gifted individuals focused on understanding the human condition through the scientific study of paranormal and psychical phenomena. And coming October 2008 to Tampa, Florida, the Paranexus Conference, a learning and networking event unlike any you've attended. Join us for 2 full days of innovative paranormal workshops. Participate in the Paranexus Challenge, where several teams will investigate a secret haunted location, observe a live table tipping seance at the stroke of midnight. Join us for the Spirits and Shadows Costume Ball. See old friends, meet new friends, win prizes, and have fun.
Paranexus.org.
A place to learn, a place to share, a place to network, a place to come together. Join us now at Paranexus.org. Welcome back, everybody. This is Paranexus Universe. Doug Kelly here with Grant. Hey, Grant.
Hey, Doug. I keep fading in and out, but it's good to be here.
I think you're the one who's been messing around with a Ouija board this time.
That's supposed to be a secret.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't have podcast it. Anyway, we're here with our special guest, Bill Nell. Welcome back, Bill.
Thank you.
Now, of course, you know a lot. Lots and lots about UFOs, but you've also done some other types of paranormal research, haven't you?
Oh, yeah, and it's good because, you know, when you deal with UFOs all the time, you know, it's really nice when a good ghost case comes along or something, you know. I mean, it's just fun. It's really nice because I have a general and very eclectic interest in the paranormal, so, you know, for me it's very cool when I can take a break for one or the other and do something else.
Let's talk about some of that. What else... Bring up a case that you've been on that perhaps relating to ghosts or something that you found interesting and valuable in terms of learning.
Well, I've had some really good experiences in terms of the ghost cases. Just to give you a short one, a couple of years ago, I did a radio show from Edgar Allan Poe's grave,
yep.
Of all places, in Maryland. And I got to tell you, that was a pretty interesting experience because... I had this morning show does this once every year on Halloween, and I just happened to be speaking at a college there in that area on Halloween, and the radio show invited me on to talk about my upcoming seminar, and it was going to be Halloween afternoon, and then, you know, so it wouldn't interfere with trick-or-treating that night, and we went to Edgar Allan Poe's grave, which is under a church, literally, and it's a crawl space, but it's a pretty big, it's probably about a 5-foot ceiling. And they set up their equipment and put everything in there, and, you know, and I kind of warned them. I said, don't take this the wrong way, because I think that no one should take the paranormal too seriously. But, you know, ghosts are a different thing. They're not like UFOs, and, you know, they can involve real entities. So I wouldn't play around with it too much. And, of course, they didn't listen to me. And all their equipment kept going out for no apparent reason. I mean, there were power outages. Just, you know, stuff just died just like that. And it was kind of funny because the imam also that was on with me, a really wonderful lady who was obviously very, very sensitive, and she was pretty much saying the same thing. So I thought that was a pretty interesting experience. But some of the ghost cases I've worked on really have scared the, you know, daylights out of me. One of the ones that I remember that really interested me, I'm not sure if I told the story last time I was on, but I'll tell it now because it just intrigues me. I'll give you a quick couple. One was involving a fellow in Chicago who years ago when I did a seminar there, invited me over to his house, and he was hoping I'd see the specter or the spirit or the vision entity that he was seeing, and I didn't. But he said that on a weekly basis, he would see this woman walk around his house, and she looked pretty much like a full-body apparition, you know, pretty real. And he had no explanation for it. She'd, you know, turn around a corner or walk into a wall and vanish. And, you know, I looked around his house. I eventually sent someone from a spiritualist church over there because they have some pretty sensitive mediums and normally very, very reliable, and they couldn't turn up anything. So then about several years later, when I came back to the area and doing another seminar, he came out and he introduced me to a woman. He said, "Bill, this is the woman I saw in my house back then, except I only met her a year ago and married her, and now she's my wife." And I was like, whoa, you know, if there was ever a better case of precognition, I hadn't heard about it, you know. So I thought that was pretty darn impressive, you know.
Yeah,
so
really.
Then another case I worked on, which really kind of got to me, was because, you know, I was in Michigan, and I was working on a case where this group of teenagers had been trying to conjure up something on the Ouija board. And we all know, you know, Ouija boards, I'm kind of neutral on them. I don't use one. I don't recommend them. But, you know, I'm not necessarily opposed to people that do. I guess I would just say it's something you have to be very careful with. Because even if you talk to spiritualist folks and some of the people that, you know, spend a lot more time on ghosts than I do, they will tell you there's, you know, potentially good and bad spirits. By the way, you know, there's a lot of varying opinions about this. I want people to understand. I hope if you're ever going to do any ghost research, instead of just running out and buying the EMF meters and the digital recorders, I hope you buy some books and read up on it, because there's a lot of different theories. I mean, you go back to Hans Holzer, who was the very first ghost hunter and really established the modern, if you will, science or whatever you want to call it, of paranormal ghost hunting. He wrote The Ghost Hunter in 1962. You should read most of his stuff now, but see, he is strictly a spiritualist in the sense that he doesn't believe there's any demons. He thinks it's all just spirits, and that there's no bad spirits at all. I would disagree with him on that. Then you have Ed and Lorraine Warren. Of course, Ed's no longer with us, but the Warrens always believed that, in fact, there were demons, but there's also spirits, and they probably would have referred to themselves as demonologists.
Yeah.
More than anything else. So you have their opinions. I think it's good to look on both sides of the issue and make up your own mind, but I worked with this group of kids who was trying to sum it up, and this is the 70s, so they were trying to sum it up, Janis Joplin of all people, you know. And I guess one of them got hurt pretty bad, because during the time when they were doing the Ouija board, one of them became, I guess you could say, possessed, or at least, engulfed by one of the spirits, and got scratched up pretty badly. All these marks all over him and stuff, and I guess the parents had heard me on a radio interview I was doing those days and told me about it. I came over and talked to them, and there was a lot of problems there. I'll tell you, when I first went there, I mean, this has happened to me in other cases, I felt myself being touched on the leg and on the arm by unseen forces. There was definitely a heaviness that hung over the house. You know, when you do ghost hunting, it's different, and you can really feel literally the kind of spiritual energy that goes on when you have a lot of spirit activity. You can literally feel it, or at least not maybe in every case, but in some cases. And I remember getting a couple of scratches on my leg, and that really freaked me out. So I happened to get a hold of this Lutheran pastor who was somebody who had done quite a bit of ghost hunting himself, but took a more religious type of standpoint, because I felt that we were not necessarily dealing with perhaps demonic, but certainly with negative forces that may have been trapped in the house or something. The house had a very long history of paranormal activity. For example, one of the original people that played the Long Ranger on the radio had once lived in the house. And ever since he died, apparently people had seen this actor, dressed as the Long Ranger, walking through the house. So the place already had a history in the sense of being somewhat haunted. And then, you know, when you bring out a Ouija board, that probably didn't help. So he came in and he kind of, you know, did his thing and blessed the house and prayed. And it probably took about, I think, 5 or 6 days of that and some other things and kind of getting the Ouija board out of the house to bring things more down to a normal level where they weren't having the touching and the, nobody was getting hurt and there weren't any more visions at that point. But that was a pretty scary case for me.
Hmm. Yeah, and see, on the flip side of the whole Ouija board thing, you know, Grant and I tease each other about it.
Don't we, Grant?
And,
absolutely, Doug.
Yeah.
I'm here for you, Grant.
Anyway, you know.
I just dropped the planchette.
Yeah. Anyway, we just, you know, we've talked about this on the show before. It really boils down to a person's state of mind, really their self-concept, and how they accept themselves or whether they don't. That's a common thread that we have discovered through our experiences. What, Bill, let me ask you this. What, in your ghost research, what are some of the things that you feel that you have learned that are substantial that perhaps you could offer or share with other paranormal researchers? I know you've just shared some, but is there anything out there that kind of has led you down a path or a path of belief as to what they are? That sort of thing.
I'm sorry. Could you repeat that question? I'm getting a lot of echo. I'm sorry.
Sure. I'll adjust.
Now I can hear you pretty good.
Okay. The question was, have you learned anything from your ghost research, any other things that might be of value to some of the paranormal researchers that are listening? Some things that have, you know, I don't know, you just discerned some different things about that realm. Something you could share that might be beneficial.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things. First of all, I think as a paranormal researcher, you have to be spiritually neutral, okay? I think it's probably a mistake to, you know, walk into someone's house and start making pronouncements. That's the last thing you want to do. You know, you're there in their house, you know, treat them with respect or in their property. You know, discern and think and listen. Don't overreact. Don't get overexcited. Don't tell a bunch of tales. You know, let them do the talking. I think one of the most important things is to keep an open mind. You know, you have your right to your own religious views and even views, like I said, about, you know, the spiritual nature of ghosts or lack of thereof. But, you know, ghosts could be anything. I mean, there's, you know, the stone recording theory that perhaps there's some sort of, you know, recordings that are replayed over and over, especially when there's no interactions. You know, the passive theory, if you will, of ghosts. You know, there's the interactive where they react to you. You know, there's the famous case for the Petit Trianon in France where the school teacher visited there in the late 1800s and, you know, spoke to allegedly Marie Antoinette and other people as if they were still there. You know, apparently she had a case of retrocognition, a viewing of the past and the present. Then there's precognition, as with the man seeing his wife, his future wife in his house, you know, the viewing of the future and the present. There's just so many things, and then there's the spirituals, the spirits and the demons and all kinds of angels. I mean, you know, I would say that you really have to keep an open mind. Look, let me tell you something. I worked with a gal named Jenny, and Jenny was someone who was a very interesting person. She, boy, it's tough to tell the story. She was one of the members of my little UFO club in high school, okay?
Uh-huh.
And at some point, you know, I spent a lot of time with her and about three or four other people. We were kind of like a group, if you will, went out on all the investigations and stuff. And, you know, one night we were just sitting around and I was talking to her about a case and she started talking like someone else. She told me that she was an angel, literally. I mean,
really?
the whole angelic thing, yep. And I was just thinking that she was pulling my leg, you know, like, yeah, okay, right. Sure, you know. But she wasn't. She was dead serious. And, she, you know, said that my job is to deliver messages to people. And I'm like, okay, you know. And I know that one of the things she told me was that apparently one of Jenny's friends, she was a huge horse fan. I mean, she loved going horseback riding. And one of her friends went horseback riding with her, fell off the horse and was severely injured. And during that time, this angel spoke through Jenny and told the friend, basically, look, you know, you're going to be all right. And said, apparently, whenever she delivers these comforting messages, the person that got the message doesn't remember what they are, what she actually said, except that it's incredibly comforting, but later does not remember what was actually said. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this happened a few times. I spoke to a friend of Jenny's who I knew very, very well that was on the beach with her in Miami Beach when she was vacationing. She lived in St. Pete, but they went on a vacation down to Miami, and apparently this guy drowned literally in the water, which often happens down there with the riptides and everything, you know, and a kind of lack of really good lifeguards. And this happened in, I believe, 1972. He was pulled out of the water, and I guess, you know, she spoke through this kind of like as an angel, and told the family that he would be all right, even though, you know, to be honest, the guy looked dead as a doornail, and that the paramedics would arrive shortly. Now, there wasn't a paramedic in sight, and this is the day before cell phones, so you couldn't just pop open your flip phone and call, you know. People were running back to the hotel, which was a good, you know, 2 or 3 minutes away to the nearest phone to call up. But before everybody knew it, there were the paramedics. Somehow they had somebody had run up to the parking lot and found a couple of an ambulance just sitting there, apparently, and got them, and they were there. And guess what? The guy was indeed all right. I'll tell you what happened to me. My father passed away in the 1970s, and when he did, at that time, Jenny had told me about it actually before it happened. And I don't remember what she said either, you know, as this angel creature, if you will. So I had my own experience with her. I can attest to that. I can't say that I know she was an angel. I can't say that an angel was possessing her, but I can say it's one of the weirdest darn things I've ever, experienced in my own life. And there are people like that. That's happened. I've spoken to a number of people who've told me the same story. So, you know, you have to be open-minded because, I mean, if I just, you know, it would be just as wrong of me to dismiss that out of hand as it would be to, believe it out of hand. You know, you have to investigate it and see what's going on because there's going to be stuff that you're going to run up against, especially with ghosts and things like that, that you're not going to like very much, you know. Yeah. I mean, you're just not going to like it. It's going to scare the daylights out of you. It's going to make you mad. It's going to make you sometimes, although it shouldn't, it's going to make you question some of your belief systems. But you know what? Take it all in stride. You know, nothing that ever happens in the paranormal should ever shake your faith, if you have a faith, because if you do and it shakes it, it wasn't much of a faith to begin with, you know? Because you got to remember there's a lot of conflicting stories, information, and different things that go on with ghosts. And we may be misinterpreting the whole darn thing. I mean, we use the term ghost. That may be something that's completely wrong, and maybe sometime in the future we'll find that out. I mean, I can imagine in the early days of people that noticed things about UFOs, they probably got it all wrong. I mean, you know, there's always been stories of little gray guys down through history, and who knows? Maybe that was the origin of the leprechaun tales and the troll tales and the little men that were seen in Egypt and different places in Africa, little stories of little fairies. They used to build these little fairy huts in Africa. They didn't call them fairies. They called them something else that I can't even pronounce, but basically that's what they thought they were, some sort of little entities. And the little huts were designed for them as a place to stay when they visited overnight. And sometimes it took people away, but the people always came back. So, you know, these stories come down to us, but they were before anyone had the idea of an alien life form.
Well, here's a question. I know we addressed this or discussed it in our previous show a couple of weeks ago. This is a question from the chat room. What are the telltale signs that a haunting is an alien rather than a human spirit?
I tend to find a lot of physical evidence with that. Also, you know, it tends to fit the bill. I'll give you an example. I had a stockbroker come to me who was retired and she had been involved in Wall Street for 35 years, and she felt that her and her sister were haunted for at least, from the time they were little, you know, for who knows how many years, 50-some-odd years of their life. And when she started describing some of the things, for example, she said when she was little, she saw these dead relatives that would appear to her. And for the most part, they were relatives that were friendly to her situation. In other words, it wasn't some, you know, nasty aunt that she didn't like. It was always somebody friendly who she would have liked, you know, and did like before they passed on.
Uh-huh.
Then as she got to her adolescent period, she would see these, little friendly furry animals, you know, that would appear and vanish suddenly. And then later on, she'd see these little men that she thought were some kind of spirits or entities, you know, and they always seemed to appear at a time when she would lose hours and hours of time, you know. Now, here's the thing. They could walk through walls, which is something we know ghosts do, right? They could come up through floors or down through ceilings. They could go through windows. They could walk through doors. They really exhibited a lot of what we think of typically when we think of ghostly activity, but
right.
Because of the surrounding circumstances of the fact that she had, you know, she had abduction scars on her. She had missing time. One of her neighbors, who I spoke to later, said that on several occasions he had actually seen unexplained lights over her house. Now, she thought those were ghost lights because there is a phenomenon. In fact,
right.
If you guys ever go out to one of the great places, you could see some good ghost lights, or by the old Native American mounds by the Jungle Prada in St. Pete. People see them there all the time and over the intracoastal waterway as well in that area. And by the way, that's a great place for people if they like to investigate stuff. You know, you've got Al Capone's old nightclub over there. You got the Admiral Farragut Academy, which used to be, a hotel, which has had I went there for a year, so I can tell you there's a lot of hauntings that go on there. Places like that where there's just tons and tons of stuff you can actually see. But the point being that, you know, in a case like that, it was kind of easy because once you got into the details, and the devil's always in the details, you know, then you began to see there was a lot more UFO information than anything else. Now, I've worked on cases where there were both. I've worked on cases where, imagine the nightmare of being an abductee living in a haunted house. that about says it all, but I have actually experienced that. I was in a house where another abductee would constantly see these typical orbs, you know, stuff would move around. And I mean, this was very, very obviously not related to whatever UFO things were happening because these were, you know, this was a very, very ghostly activity. So, you know, you just have to, discern and you have to, again, like I said before, your best tool is the brain in your head as long as you feed it full of good things and, you know, read a lot of information. You go back and you read some of the cases that have been written down over the years by credible people, you know, and then you'll learn a lot when you do that.
Well, here's in case in point, you know, talking about some that may have both aspects, like UFO aspect as well as the spirit aspect. And, you know, and I've been saying this for a while now, and I'll continue to say it. I have a hunch that if we understand the UFO component, the extraterrestrial component, we're going to really have the upper hand on the spirit component. Here's a case in point. Grant and I are working a case in our neck of the woods, under the auspices of Paranexus Research Foundation, and it started out as a haunting type of thing. Nothing terrifying, nothing malevolent, nothing like that. But just wanted to know. And in talking with this lady, I was intrigued. And in talking with her, I also discovered she had a couple of hours of missing time here last November. So Grant and I were there last weekend, and I did a regression on her, hypnotic regression. And it was rather interesting. I always find age regressions and past life regressions terribly interesting. I'm not entirely sure I'd buy into it, but there's a lot of psychologically interesting phenomena that comes out of it. So here's what happened. We had her under hypnosis, good subject, and I regressed her back to November, and I asked her, you know, where are you at? She says, I'm in my living room. And I says, what are you doing? She was crying. Why are you crying? Some family things. And I said, are you alone? She said, no. And I asked, who else is with you? And she said, three. And I said, three what? Three who? And she didn't know what to call them. She says, I don't know what they are. I says, well, what do they look like? She says, they're clear. And I says, what do you mean they're clear? She says, like heat coming off a hot pavement. And that's the second time I've ever heard that particular phrase. Have you ever heard that, Bill?
I've never heard the phrase, but man, oh man, when you talk about that description, yes. You know, I've worked on a number of cases where people have seen these, you know, for better, they call them the invisible men, really. That's what, right. You know, my term for them is, because they look like that. You can see the outline, but that's it. You know, they're transparent, you know, clear as a bell, but you can see the outline. I've not seen them, but I know people that claim they have. Yeah, that must have been fascinating.
Well, the only other time I've heard that is recently in the Stan Romanek case. So I'd ask her, okay, well, how tall are you? She says there's two tall ones and a short one. I said, okay, well, how tall are the tall ones? She said 4.5 feet. I said, how tall is a short one? She said 3 feet. I said, well, what are they doing? She said, they're watching me. You know, and some other things came out. I says, well, what do you do next? And she says, they want me to go outside. I said, okay, so do you go outside? And yes. And I said, dude, she led and they followed and they went outside into her front yard. She's got they live on some acreage, so she's got a really big, big, huge, almost park-like front yard with a kind of a garage/barn at the other end, probably, I don't know, 200 yards or so away. I said, well, what do you do? And she says, I walk north and south, south and north, back and forth. I said, why? And she didn't have an answer. And I says, well, I want you to look around you. I want you to look up in the sky. What kind of a day is it? And she says, it's a beautiful day. I says, well, what do you see in the sky? She says, I see clouds. And then she starts adding, you know, I can't even remember the picture. I have to listen to the audio again. But she was saying some shapes that she was seeing what the clouds were making. And she's naming them off. And one of the ones is a ship. And Grant's over there trying to slap the hell out of me, saying, you know, ask her what kind of ship. So I finally got the message, because sometimes I can be blonde, but don't tell anybody that, because I have the whole world fooled, okay? Anyway, so I asked her, you know, is the ship a cloud that you see? She said, no. I said, well, how do you know it's a ship? She says, I just know. She said, I said, well, what does it look like? She says, it's clear. That was interesting. And the next thing to come out of it was that she just, you know, they released her, so to speak, and she woke up out in the front yard. And I said, how long were you involved in this? She said, 3 hours. That was under hypnosis. Otherwise, she told me 2 hours. So that was an interesting case, you know. And, you know, of course, we don't quite know what to make of it yet, and I'm going to continue to do some regressions with her, and I'd like to explore that again, see if we can get any more out of it. Interesting case, though.
Oh, that's amazing. I was working on a case where a guy was laying on his couch, and he was an abductee, and I'd agreed to spend the night, you know, sitting up in a chair and kind of like watching, because he'd had so many experiences, and he kept seeing these clear people. They weren't the only things he saw, by the way, but, you know, the clear people were definitely a big part of her, you know, of her experience, and, of his experience. So one of the things that happened that really blew my mind was, and I hate that. I just don't like it when they're there, you know, and I'm there. And then it's like, oh, yeah, there's this big guy. You know, and it's funny you said that, because it's kind of like, to them, a big guy would be someone over 4 feet tall, you know, of one of these creatures.
Uh-huh.
And there's a big guy, you know, touching my leg. I'm like, why is he touching your leg? I don't know. Well, the next morning, he woke up with a broken leg. Now, I cannot explain that, because I can tell you I was there all night, and I don't believe, you know, to my memory, he didn't get up even to use the bathroom from the couch. He laid on the couch all night.
Absolutely.
So how can you, you know, wake up with a broken leg? I don't get that. But definitely, you know, he saw one of these clear guys, which I like to call the invisible men, and, you know, he had a broken leg. So what did they do? Why? You know, what would make the sense? So sometimes, yeah, you just kind of walk out of something like that, and you say, man, oh, man, what do I do with a case like this, you know?
Yeah, I mean, what do you make of it, you know?
Yeah, there's no easy way. Something like that, I mean, it's pretty obvious that you're dealing with something that probably has to do with aliens. But look at Jacques Vallée. I mean, you know, him talking about he was so ahead of his time, I believe, in many ways, although a lot of people, you know, kind of like blew him off in those days when he talked about the beings that were interdimensional. I mean,
right.
I talked earlier about the Jungle Prada, and I can tell you I've come to believe that that area is a definite portal, a time-space portal, because people have seen everything from ghosts to ghost lights to lots of UFOs. And even Bigfoot, and I mean Bigfoot with evidence, and I believe there's definitely a portal in that area, because one of the things I found about some of the Bigfoot cases I've worked on, I've not worked on many, but almost every case where there's a lot of evidence and they come and go, and I'm talking about cases in suburban areas, not out in the woods. I've never done a case like that where it's really out in the woods. There always seems to be other activity, as if there's some kind of a time-space portal where these beings are able to come and go at will.
You know,
the thing that's always so fascinating about Jacques is that what I like about him, Bill, and Doug, is the fact that he basically says, we don't know what it is. We don't know whether it's something that's been here with us and co-inhabited this planet or is interdimensional. But whatever the phenomena is, it almost likes to deceive us or misrepresent itself. I'm not saying he's attaching any negativity to it, but it's almost like maybe we've got some sort of symbiotic relationship with something that's been here for a long time that's not necessarily extraterrestrial.
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. In fact, if anyone ever gets a chance, because when you go to my website at ufoguide.com, I got lots of good DVDs and stuff, so make sure you spend all your money there. But if you have any left over, after they spend money on tickets for your upcoming event, they should also go and either buy or rent UFOs Are Real. That's an excellent documentary. And also, UFOs It Has Begun. That was an awesome documentary with Jacques Vallée in it, one of the best ever. And people need to see that, because even though the things like from the late 70s, I got news for you, that documentary probably has more information in 10 minutes of the footage that you watch than most today do in their entire presentation. And they've got the cattle mutilations. You know, Jacques Vallée takes a look at everything, including his own theories and that. And, man, it's worth a watch for sure.
And it just re-released Masters of Deception, I think.
I see that. Yeah, isn't that amazing?
It just re-released that. So for anybody who wants to really look at somebody who's been on the cutting edge of what maybe what the phenomenon may be, you know, Jacques is out there. But very readable and very, you know, very intelligent guy with a background in traditional science and computers, right, Bill?
And you know what? You have to remember something, too. In the beginning of ufology, there was really only a few people. There was, you know, Donald Kehoe, Jacques Vallée, Ivan T. Sanderson, who wrote not only about UFOs, but a lot of, you know, he was a very good paranormal investigator in terms of the work he did, because he wrote about so many different paranormal and Fortean type issues, you know. Chris John Keel, who doesn't love John Keel? You know, I saw him years ago in New York City, and I'll never forget what he said. It was hilarious. You know, we're talking about the relationships between different paranormal things and aliens. He said, you know, there's no dumb aliens, only stupid UFO investigators. The typically Keelian thing to say, you know. And I thought, you know what, that guy is so right. He's really so right on. I think that there's a lot of things in his head. He's a brilliant writer. He's somewhat of a lazy writer in the sense that, you know, since he stopped writing the articles, he's never written a lot of books or anything. But you know what? I wish he would, because there's probably more knowledge in that guy's head than there is in, you know, five or eight of us all put together. You know, the people that have been out there in the field and really investigated this stuff, that's why it's good, like with Jacques Lay and to read his stuff and Ivan T. Sanderson. And even Whitley Strieber, you know, I've known Whitley a long time over the years, and, you know, I'll tell you something, people knock him a lot, but you know what, if you've ever spent some time actually talking to him, you would know instantly that, you know, his experiences are in fact real, and although he may write them in a very intellectual way, perhaps not so readable like what we're used to, because we're all used to the dime novel thing and the Pulp Fiction thing, but you know what, his books are a good read, because I'll tell you, some of the stuff that he's been through and people that have visited his house, you know, in upstate New York, man, oh, man, the stuff that's gone up there, it just scares the daylights out of you, stuff that's gone on. So it's another good read. But apart from that, I'm sorry to say there's not a whole lot of good books out there anymore. A lot of it's just repetitive information. That's why I'm writing one now. I'm actually writing about the beginnings of my UFO investigation, because I realized when I started writing it, you know, this isn't going to fit in a book, so I'm going to write one book about when I was a kid and started this until I was about 20 years old, and then I'll just have to do the rest and the best I can over a period of years, because, I mean, I started to figure out how many cases I did, and I don't know, I got to a couple of thousand, and then I stopped counting. I said, man, oh, man, this is ridiculous. What have I been doing with my time?
Hey, Bill, if we could switch gears a little bit, I'd really like to ask you some questions about the Philadelphia experiment, you know. I'm really a skeptic about the Philadelphia experiment, and maybe I'm basing that on the fact that some of the things that I've read, and I'm trying to remember the key component person in there that, you know, Juan Carlos?
Carlos Allende.
Carlos Allende, and you know, he, in some of the things that I've read, he was really kind of discredited and made up to be like kind of a psychotic or schizophrenic guy who, you know, went on these rantings. And I know that you know who these people are, so bear with me. There was also somebody that was very reputable that committed suicide in conjunction with that.
Morris K. Jessup, yes.
Can you elaborate on that for our audience and for me too, if you would? Please?
Sure. I'm fascinated by it because, you know what, when I first started reading about it, I actually read about it in the back of Ivan T. Sanderson book. He had written this book, and I think it might have been called Invisible Horizons. I'm not sure, because it's been years since I touched the book. But when I started reading these Allende letters, I was really fascinated. And then I started looking up Jessup, and I was more fascinated, because Jessup is just like, you know, it's one of those subjects, just before I begin, so people understand, that there's so many different people that have come up with so much information that if it isn't true, it would be the greatest synchronicity and coincidence in the human history. I mean, Morris K. Jessup wrote a book on UFOs in which he alleged to have figured out some of the ways that UFOs propel themselves. And he came up with a kind of like, you know, he was an early supporter of the time-space theory and the gravity drives, which we all pretty much believe today. And apparently, Allende read his book, and he said, well, you have it, but you don't have it all. He said, I'm going to tell you about an experiment that I witnessed while I was a merchant marine on the USS Furiouset off the coast of Jersey in the 1940s, when the U.S. Navy was involved in a series of experiments to, first of all, defeat German mines, because they had invented a new type of magnetic mine that was attracted to the magnetized metal of battleships and other naval vessels. And the idea was to be able to degauss them fast, to be able to place detectors at, you know, both sonic sound detectors and also motion detectors in all the harbors, the major harbors in the United States. It was a multifaceted project. But see, what they did was they grabbed a bunch of physicists that were working under people like von Neumann, the, you know, computer creator, you know, Einstein, who was contracted to the Navy in the 1940s, and we still don't know what he did for them. You know, all these different people, younger physicists were working under them. And the idea was for them to go and work on these projects and also create kind of a stealthy anti-radar system, because radar was new, but the Germans, they had really fine-tuned the stuff. I mean, they literally were said to have the best radar during World War II. And, of course, with all their advanced planes, they had the first jets and all that other stuff. It doesn't surprise me that they had that. But it was a problem. Now, what the young physicists that were chosen to work on this out of Princeton University didn't tell the Navy was that they saw the Navy as the goose that laid the golden egg. I mean, it was a huge amount of money. They were never going to get this opportunity again. So they were going to test all their new theory. I mean, it's one thing to come up with a theory. It's another thing to build the mechanics to prove it. And what that was their idea. We're going to build the mechanics to prove it. So they didn't say anything, but they were not only going to make, you know, Navy vessels stealthy in terms of radar invisible, but they were going to shoot for the moon. They were going to go and try to make them visually invisible. And I guess in the process of developing different theories and how they could do it, they came up with the idea of displacing time and space. You know, it was really advanced for the time. And one of the problems, you know, was they didn't really have the computers or anything to do it. Everything had to be set by hand. So to make a long story short, I guess during one of the early exercises, they did at the Philadelphia Navy shipyard, that's why it's called the Philadelphia Experiment. They chose that location because of its proximity to Princeton. It was only a few miles away from Princeton University. They apparently took a ship, a naval escort that had yet to be commissioned, put a bunch of caged animals on board, and attempted to make the ship both radar invisible and visually invisible. Now, there were problems because even though it did become invisible, both to radar and visually invisible, by the way, the Navy people that witnessed the test were stunned because that wasn't what they were expecting, and there were senators there and other people that were, you know, specifically invited. Apparently what happened was some of the animals became burned. They died. They started to show signs of insanity. Some of them had actually melted into the cells, bars of their cages or even into the deck. That was bad news, but, you know, the Navy went full steam ahead because, hey, they had discovered something cool. And I guess after making what they felt were some changes, one of the people that was involved in the Philadelphia experiment but quit was Tesla. They involved him because they felt that, well, you know, he was someone who was used to working with unusual frequencies. And I think if he had stayed on, probably the thing would have worked fine, but he didn't. And eventually when they did this particular test that the Furiouset witnessed, that Allende witnessed, the ship, in fact, became invisible. They saw a green mist come up from the hull of the ship. And apparently, the ship vanished. It reappeared. When it reappeared, though, there was the same problem. You had members of the crew stuck in the deck. You know, people died. Some of the members of the crew floated off, were never seen again. 2 weeks after the test, there was an article in the Philadelphia Inquirer, which talked about a bar fight where these guys that were standing out in front of the bar became transparent to people in broad daylight. All of a sudden, the shore patrol came and pulled them away. two other guys floated out the back of the bar. They thought they went into the back room until they discovered there was no back room to the bar. You know, I mean, I could go on and on. One of the people that I met was the father of a bride-to-be of one of my best friends who had worked at the shipyard there in the 1940s. And, in fact, one of his best friends was involved in the Philadelphia Experiment. Now, let me say that we had that conversation about it in 1972, long before any of the books were written about it. So, again, you know, I started getting this information from books in the 60s and witnesses in the 70s. You know, by the time I met, of course, three of the most famous people that are associated, for better or worse, with the Philadelphia Experiment would be Preston Nichols and Al Bielek and Duncan Cameron. I was the first person to introduce them to the public because they all had some sort of connection to the Philadelphia Experiment, which later became the Phoenix Project, which later ended up being done at Montauk, at the Montauk base on Long Island. I guess I'll stop there in case you have any questions or want to kind of, you know, want me to comment more on one thing or less on another. It's a very complicated story. So
yeah.
I do have a DVD on it. I have several, but the truth about the Philadelphia Experiment is like, shoot, I think it's 8 hours long. And if you want a good watch, if you want to watch something that will change your life, go to UFOGuy.com and order it. I've got to send you guys a copy because it's pretty compelling stuff.
And that's the Philadelphia Experiment. What's the name of the DVD again?
The Truth About the Philadelphia Experiment, just so you know, and here's another odd thing about it. The first time I was able to get Preston, Duncan, and Al together and film them, I filmed about 6 hours with them, and I've added other information as well to that and updated some as well. You know, one of the things that happened during the filming was, and this really blew me away years later. Now, this was filmed in 1989, and originally, the original part of it. Again, as I said, I've updated, so there's a lot of new stuff in there as well. But when we were filming it, we were at a friend of Preston's house who lived right behind him. And talk about white trucks with black tires just circling the street while we were there. That really freaked me out because I've never seen that before in all the years of investigations I've done. Also, another thing that really blew me away was they got to a point where they talked about being at some future point. Because, see, with the Philadelphia Experiment, they not only discovered how to make something invisible, but how to move forward and backward through time and space. And some of the frequencies they use affect people's minds. So they also discovered how to, in a sense, establish a level of mind control. And
right.
They did all these things. They tried doing all these things at Montauk. But one of the things that really got to me was how that Al and Duncan had traveled to some point in New York City, you know, at an unknown point in the future where they saw what they felt was an iron horse and a lot of debris all around them. And they said they stopped. They said, we can't say any more about this. I'm like, well, don't stop now. He said, no, we can't. And, you know, years later, it dawned on me when I saw the World Trade Center tragedy, the terrorist attacks of 9/11, I saw the structure, the sculpture that had sat between the trade centers. And if you looked at it after it was damaged, it looked like a huge metal horse. And I went back and I watched the tape and I said, man, they said everything was on fire. There was debris everywhere, you know. There was no living people around, just dust everywhere. I'm like, my God, in 1988, they described the 2001 attacks.
Really?
And that's probably why they stopped. And I have that on tape. You can watch it. You know, I mean, it's there. And the thing is, maybe that's why they stopped. It's like, I can't say anymore. That spooked me. You know, just when you don't want to believe these guys and stuff. I mean, I remember going to the base myself and spending a lot of time there on many occasions, looking for evidence to prove what went on there and constantly finding it. You know, again, I'm a nuts and bolts investigator. You know, I don't want to believe everybody's story that comes along, but man, oh man, there's a lot of evidence. So if you want me to stop here for a second in case you have any questions.
So in your mind, is the Philadelphia Experiment true?
Yes, I believe it is because, again, you know, multi-sources, you know, many, many, many different sources. You know, it's true that you can take a story and retell it and it changes over the years. But see, the Philadelphia Experiment doesn't really change. And in fact, what's interesting is I've met all these different people that have absolutely no connection with each other, none. And they all said things to me that have been very, you know, it's all been pretty much the same thing. Now, you have to understand, you know, when I first heard a lot of these things, science and technology has changed quite a bit. So some of the things that were described to me back then, I'm certain that, you know, I probably couldn't have appreciated as much today as I did then, but that's what makes it all the more true. is that I could see what they were doing now, and I can understand it now, whereas, you know, when they described it to me back then, the best thing I could do is kind of like shrug my shoulders and take what they were saying as for face value and try to prove it as best as I could. But, you know, it became a major interest of mine. So whenever I had a chance to look into it or find someone that had some knowledge about it, I did. So I've really spent a lot of time on it. And again, I like the information because let me tell you this brief story real fast.
Sure.
Because this may have a relation. You know, you all know, I grew up on Long Island. You know, I lived in a block where there were a lot of former government people and, you know, ex-military. And one of the people that lived on my block that really freaked me out were the Munces. The guy was a retired scientist. He'd worked for the government for years. His wife had been involved with the government as well. And, you know, they kind of stuck to themselves. They never had children or anything. But they were nice people all in all, you know. But over the years, I've met people that lived on that block. And I got to tell you, I'm the only one that not only remembers that they lived there, but for some reason, I'm the only one with pictures of their house. Everyone else that lived in my block on Chester Drive in East Meadow, Long Island, New York, their pictures don't show that house.
Huh, really?
So how the hell do you explain that?
That's,
I mean,
what they show.
It's just not there. You know, it's like removing nothing, just another house. I mean, the house that was next to it on either side is there, but not their house. Why? And what? You know what really freaked me? I'll tell you what made me aware of it was sometime in the 80s, I was talking to my mom. My mom passed away recently, the last couple of years. But back then, I was talking to her about it, and I said, you know who I think of every once in a while? Because Mrs. Munch used to make these wonderful pies. Oh, my goodness. You know, it was like the old days where they put them on the windowsill to, you know, to kind of like cool off, and you'd smell that glorious odor of nice fresh apple or pumpkin pies or blueberry pies, you know. The woman was a baking fool, you know, she's always baking something. And, man, I love that smell, and she'd always give the kids some stuff, you know. And, I mean, she was really nice. She was well known in the neighborhood. I know my mom went over there a bunch of times. My mom didn't know she had no idea who I was talking about.
You're kidding.
No, and I thought, well, you know, mom's getting on in years. Maybe she just forgot. But, I mean, I started to look through her photos, and I saw that. And I said, you don't remember this house? I said, I never saw that house before. I can't believe it's even in there. Like, why do I remember it then? You know, what is that? What is this whole thing? So I can't explain it all. There's only one other person that I grew up with that remembers the Munces, remembers the house, and that was a guy named Wayne who lived across the street from me, because he lived right next door to them, but nobody else does. I mean, they swear that the house was never there. I can't explain something like that, except to say that if the guys that talk about the Philadelphia experiment are telling the truth, perhaps for some reason they wipe these people from existence, because, hey, if they have the power to time travel, that's more power than we know.
Well,
they could literally wipe someone out of existence. You know, it scares the daylights out of you, but it also might explain why the time from World War II on has been some of the most politically and economically and in every other way historically unstable times in all of human history.
Do you think it could have been a timeline issue, a timeline change?
Well, I think if you keep skewing timelines, you're going to have that. If you're going to have economic, political, and social madness going on, which is pretty much what we've had ever since the end of World War II. I mean, it's like, you know, there's certain things. You know, let me ask you something. Let me challenge you and your listeners to this, okay? And I'll tell you what I mean. I'll tell you why I think changes are made even today. How many times have you guys read a book and you swear that it was different, it was written differently, or you watched a movie and you swear that a line of dialogue was different?
Yeah, it's happened.
Yeah. And, I mean, I've got a very good memory. I'm blessed with it. I mean, I have an excellent memory. In fact, such a good memory that I can only watch a movie once. I always remember the ending, so I can never enjoy it. I mean, I can enjoy it again and watch it and like it, but I know what's going to happen. You know, you can't fool me with that. It's got just one of those guys. You know, I could sit down and write a book of everything I've ever done just from memory with just maybe a few notes about specifics. But, you know, I'm one of those people. So, you know, it would be near impossible for me to forget, you know, something that was said or written in a book or said in the movie and have it turn out a different way. And I've had that happen a number of times. So, you know, I think the government is trying to change things. And I think that Preston, Al Duncan, a lot of the other people have talked about the Philadelphia experiment are absolutely correct in their assessment that the government has been unable to successfully get timelines to where they want them to be. And I think in the process of trying to do that, they've made one heck of a mess.
So here's a question in that regard from the chat room. Any indication whether they've tried to do it again?
Oh, I think they've tried to do it again and again and again. I don't think they've ever stopped. One of the things that happened during the original Philadelphia experiment, because as I said, I mean, it's a big story, so it's hard to tell in a short amount of time, but they noticed that a number of people said that disc-shaped objects appeared over the ship, and in fact that aliens might have even been seen walking on board, because we may have discovered the frequencies or the technology by which they're able to transverse or, travel through time and space, except that we didn't have the control factors, we didn't have the computers to be able to successfully do it, without hurting ourselves. I think that, and in fact, everyone that's ever had intimate knowledge about the Rainbow Project or Phoenix Project or Philadelphia Experiment has said that it did involve at least some level of alien technology, which I think that's basically true. I know I worked on another case where this was tried with an aircraft, where in 1966, a C-130 took off from Eglin Air Force Base here in Florida, and UFOs surrounded because they were turning on technology that was similar to the technology from the Philadelphia experiment to try to make the ship, to try and make the aircraft, invisible. This was a personal project of Robert McNamara's, actually. And apparently the plane vanished, the UFO vanished. They appeared seconds later over Hampton Bays, Virginia, near the Naval Air Station, tried to land and were shot at. One of the crew members was shot. He fell out the back of the plane. They closed the huge door, took off again, turned on the technology. They had everything but missiles being shot at them. And they appeared back over Eglin seconds later after they turned on, and I'm making this a short version, of course, for time. When they got back over Eglin, the UFO and the C-130 collided. I met two of the people that were on that plane in the 1980s in Virginia, and they basically told me that the reason that they were shot at when they tried to land at Hampton Bays was that they had transversed time to the year 1982 in Hampton Bays. And that, in fact, how could you take off on a training mission or a scientific mission in 1962 on a C-130 and the one person that died have a death certificate that read 1982?
Really?
So, and they had all the documents. I mean, they came out to my seminar, told me the story. I mean, I had the biggest headache for 4 or 5 days because, you know, like I said, you reach these pinnacle moments, you know, just when you thought you've heard it all.
You know,
and I'm going through these documents. You know what? They told me. They went to NBC, you know, the New York Times, all these CNN, Fox, everybody with all this stuff, you know, and everybody kind of laughed at them. But hey, you know what? They had the Freedom of Information documents. They had the crew members' names. They were part of the crew. I mean, how much better can it get than that? You know, it's just one of those cases. It was direct. It was actually also a direct confirmation that the Philadelphia experiment not only had happened, but they had tried to make other things invisible as well. There's even been stories of invisible soldiers. I mean, I don't know how far it goes. I do know that some of the people that were involved in the Philadelphia experiment never did become visible and were locked away in mental institutions for the rest of their life. At least that's the stories I've been told.
One of the things that's always kind of troubled me about the Philadelphia experiment, and maybe you can enlighten me, is, you know, first of all, what kind of power source were they using to generate magnetic fields of that magnitude on a destroyer, which is a relatively small ship?
Right.
Do you know what were they operating? I mean, my dad was on the Navy during World War II, and he talked about the degaussing mechanisms on board the ship. But,
right.
You know, I'm just kind of curious. What was the mechanism? Do you know, Bill?
Well, I know that they had support ships, and my feeling was, because this was new technology, you know, my feeling was that the power not only came from the which later became the USS Eldridge, but also the support ships, because there were at least 5 support ships surrounding this particular, you know, ship. Now, I believe, a lot of the power, there was a power plant on board, but I also think there were backup power plants. Now, one of the problems was they were trying to generate so much power in a very new and unique way. If you ever get a chance to watch a DVD, I'm going to send you guys the DVDs, you watch them, then we can discuss them sometime, because Preston is someone who's technologically knowledgeable. He's an electronics engineer, so he explains it in a way that I can see where they were able to do it, but because I'm not electronically, savvy in terms of, you know, power and electricity and engineering, stuff like that, I wouldn't be able to explain to you.
What would you say now, Bill?
Okay.
What would you say now is, here we are in 2008, what would you say has been the spinoff of all of those experiments? What's the stage of that technology now? What do you think?
I think that the stage is quite incredible, but I think it still creates a lot of chaos. Look, let me tell you something. When I went to Montauk, one of the first things I saw and photographed was literally six locomotive-sized power generators. I'd never seen anything like it in my entire life. They claimed that they were for the original radar station, but anyone that knows anything about SAGE radar knows you didn't need six, you know, locomotive-sized power generators to run a SAGE radar, even with all the power it ate. I mean, there was a lot of power generated. I tell you, you know, I'll be honest with you, too. If I had not been able to probably go to that base and see some of the stuff that Preston and Al Duncan were talking about, see some of the damage that was done there, allegedly, of the experiment, there was a case where they used the old radar dish to beam a signal out every Tuesday and Thursday night during certain parts of the early 1980s to try and test the mind control portion of the Philadelphia experiment, where they tried to make people do certain things. And all they did was make them angry. I mean, you had towns around there like the Hamptons and other places that hadn't had any problems, any major crimes or anything, murders, since the Revolutionary War days. Most of them didn't even have their own police forces. They had, you know, either private security or Suffolk County Police. But on Tuesday and Thursday nights during those years, people were going nutty. There were bar fights, domestic disputes. You know, the police board would just light up. And I collected a whole bunch of newspaper articles from that time to prove it, that in fact they were doing something that was making people go nutty. You know, again, the sad part is that here we are in 2008, and they still haven't perfected the thing, because I don't think it's something you can perfect. I think all they've done is create a whole lot of chaos, which we're all dealing with today. I mean, I don't want to even begin to consider the ramifications of the changes they've tried to make, but right. I'm certain that a whole lot of people aren't here that probably should be here, and a whole lot of people are probably in charge that might not should be in charge. I don't know.
Well,
I mean, if you had someone like Robert McNamara messing around with the stuff in the 60s, who was somebody known to be suffering from all kinds of mental problems, you know, man, oh, man, you know, if you put someone like that in charge, what do you think's going to happen? So I can just imagine the damage that they've done with this technology. And I use the word damage because I don't see where, up to this point at least, anything good's come out of it. But you know what? It must be working, because I noticed that the Navy's canceling all these contracts for stealth battleships, because quite frankly, I think they've found a better way and don't need them.
All right, we're coming up on the end of the show. It's been a interesting show, a lot of interesting information, Bill. And to our listeners, be sure and check out Bill's website, UFOGuy.com. A lot of interesting stuff there, a lot of information, his DVDs. Looking forward to those too myself. So, Bill, thanks so much for coming back. I mean, you're an interesting guy to talk to and listen to.
Email me after the show too with you guys' address. I can send you DVDs, and then you can tell your audience a little bit about them as well.
Yeah, and we'll have you back too.
I love to do it. Love to do it.
Yeah, so
it's always a pleasure.
So
Bill, you guys keep up the good work, and hey, you listeners out there, come on. Get some tickets and go to their events and support these guys, because you know what? There's not too many folks like them around, and they're doing yeoman's work, doing some awesome paranormal research. So please get out there and support their work.
Thanks so much, Bill. And we appreciate our listeners tuning in every week. Next week, we're going to be having Dr. PMH Atwater back to discuss Beyond the Indigo Children and some of her work. We had her on last week, and she's got some more to share with us on a different topic. So tune in next week for her. We're really running out of time. We really appreciate everybody listening. Visit Paranexus.org. We've got new registration rates at $99 for the upcoming conference this October. Hope to have you. So everybody have a great night. Grant, thanks so much for hanging in there, man.
Yeah, well, I was out in the ether a few times there, Doug, but it's always a pleasure, and it's always nice to be here with Bill, too. So good night, everybody, and we'll see you next week. We're looking forward to seeing Dr. Atwater again.
Good night, everybody.
In the night, in the shadows, in the sky, it's Paranexus Universe.